Well, we return this evening to our series in the book of Acts. Last time that we were in Acts, Paul was in Athens discussing the gospel with philosophers of Athens. From there, as we'll hear tonight, Paul will travel to Corinth, and then we will learn of his time there. And so with that in mind, we turn now to our text, Acts chapter 18, from verse 1 through the first half of verse 18. Please do listen carefully. This is God's word for us this evening. After this, Paul left Athens and went to Corinth, and he found a Jew named Aquila, a native of Pontus, recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius had commanded all the Jews to leave Rome. And he went to see them, and because he was of the same trade, he stayed with them and worked, for they were tent makers by trade. And he reasoned in the synagogue every Sabbath and tried to persuade Jews and Greeks. When Silas and Timothy arrived from Macedonia, Paul was occupied with the word, testifying to the Jews that the Christ was Jesus. And when they opposed and reviled him, he shook out his garments and said to them, "Your blood be on your own heads. I am innocent. From now on, I will go to the Gentiles." And he left there and went to the house of a man named Titius Justus, a worshiper of God. His house was next door to the synagogue. Crispus, the ruler of the synagogue, believed in the Lord together with his entire household. And many of the Corinthians, hearing Paul, believed and were baptized. And the Lord said to Paul one night in a vision, "Do not be afraid, but go on speaking, and do not be silent, for I am with you. And no one will attack you to harm you, for I have many in this city who are my people." And he stayed a year and 6 months teaching the word of God among them. But when Gallio was proconsul of Achaia, the Jews made a united attack on Paul and brought him before the tribunal, saying, "This man is persuading people to worship God contrary to the law." But when Paul was about to open his mouth, Gallio said to the Jews, "If it were a matter of wrongdoing or vicious crime, O Jews, I would have reason to accept your complaint. But since it is a matter of questions about words and names and your own law, see to it yourselves. I refuse to be a judge of these things." And he drove them from the tribunal. And they all seized Sosthenes, the ruler of the synagogue, and beat him in front of the tribunal. But Gallio paid no attention to any of this. After this, Paul stayed many days longer and then took leave of the brothers and set sail for Syria, and with him Priscilla and Aquila. This is the word of the Lord. So in our text tonight, we have a summary of Paul's time in Corinth. And there's a lot that happens here, and so it can feel maybe a bit disjointed as we hear a passage like this. But what unites this passage, I think, are two things. One is that each of the events, or each of the main events, we could say, that's described here is actually fairly unexpected. And the other is that each of the events makes sense only once we take Jesus' words to Paul into account. Paul here, as we'll look at in some more detail, Paul turns to an unexpected trade in the Greek world with unexpected partners, targeting an unexpected mission field with unexpected persistence while receiving protection from unexpected defenders and then achieving unexpected results. Now, we may not see all of that right away in our first reading, but it is there, and we'll break it down in just a minute. But off the bat, an early reader who knew Paul's cultural setting and who read this text carefully would note that Paul's account here is, in some way, one unexpected thing happening after another. But Luke doesn't just present that to us as a series of unexpected events or a stroke of good fortune or agreeable coincidence that just happened to line up. At the center of it all, he puts the words that Jesus speaks to Paul, which makes sense of all of the events we see play out here. Listen again to verses 9 and 10. "And the Lord said to Paul one night in a vision, 'Do not be afraid, but go on speaking and do not be silent, for I am with you. And no one will attack you to harm you, for I have many in this city who are my people.'" There are several details of Jesus' promises and commands. They are, of course, specific to Paul and his particular circumstances. But three, we might say, major assumptions, really three major theological truths, underlie those promises that Jesus makes here. And those three truths apply to us just as much as they did here to Paul. The first is that Jesus is always with his people. Jesus states that clearly in verse 10. He says to Paul, "I am with you." It's helpful to remember that that wasn't a special promise that Jesus just made to Paul. It's rather a promise that Jesus made to all of his people, to his church, telling them in the Great Commission, "Behold, I am with you always, to the end of the age." Jesus is with his people, not just with Paul, but also with you and with me. That's the first theological truth that lies at the heart of this text. The second is found underlying what Jesus said to Paul next. He says to him, "No one will attack you to harm you." Now, we should recognize that with what's happened so far, in Paul's particular circumstances, that's really quite a statement. Because lots of people want to attack Paul, to harm him. And some of them are quite powerful. Moreover, Paul lived in the Roman Empire, a profound superpower that crushed its enemies at will, and which in other situations would oppose and persecute the church brutally. But Jesus says that he will not allow any such forces to harm Paul while he's in Corinth. With that simple statement, we should note that Jesus here is asserting that he is more powerful than the most powerful nation on earth. He asserts his sovereignty over not just the forces of the world around Paul, but also the people who fill that world. Jesus here reminds Paul that he is sovereign over every aspect of creation, which again brings to mind for us the Great Commission, where Jesus said to his people, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me." Jesus is sovereign. But then a third theological assumption underlying this text and underlying Jesus' words to Paul here is that Jesus will do whatever he wills to do. Jesus, we need to remember, isn't some force or math equation or algorithm that runs the universe. He's a person. And he's going to do whatever it is that he wills to do. Now, of course, he's good, he's supremely good, and his will is good, which is what gives us such assurance and hope and peace over his kingship. But we also need to remember that that doesn't reduce Jesus to an impersonal force. He is a personal king who does what he wills to do in this world. And those are the three theological truths that underlie Jesus' words to Paul, that Jesus is always with his people, that Jesus is always sovereign, and that Jesus will always do what he wills to do. Those are the theological truths that underlie the specific promises that Jesus gives Paul here. And it's really those theological truths that make sense of this passage, because while on a first reading, these verses may just read like an account of a few random things that happened while Paul was in Corinth, on a closer reading, we should realize that these verses are full of unexpected things that happened. Now, as we consider that, and as that is our focus this evening, to give the disclaimer, not to please don't hear what I'm not saying. The message of this text is not to assume that unexpected things that we'd like to happen are going to happen. That would be presumption, not faith. And if we've paid attention to the book of Acts up to this point, we couldn't possibly take that lesson away when we come to this text. Yes, here in Corinth, Jesus tells Paul that he will be protected and he will have success. And in a sense, that's unexpected. But many other times, Paul was met with the rejection and with the persecution that one might expect. In Antioch of Pisidia, Paul and Barnabas were opposed by the Jews there who rejected them and who stirred up the leaders of the city to persecute them, and so they fled to Iconium. In Iconium, the Jews and Gentiles together opposed them and came up with a plan to stone them, and so they fled to Lystra. In Lystra, the people actually did stone Paul, and they dragged him out of the city and left him there for dead. And so Paul fled to Derbe. Later in Philippi, Paul and Silas were arrested. In Thessalonica, a mob formed against them and they had to flee by night. Again and again, Paul was facing the hostilities and the rejections that one might expect in a world and in a culture that is set against the Lord. And so Paul's experience in Corinth does not call us to assume that God will always grant us unexpected success or unexpected special protection as his people. But rather, in the midst of difficulty and discouragement, Paul's experience in Corinth reminds us that Jesus sometimes really will grant success and special protection to his people when they might not expect it at all. And that's significant. Because Jesus' words to Paul are a reminder that even in difficult circumstances, Jesus really is always with us. He's always sovereign, and he will do what he wills to do. And if that's true, if we really believe those things, then we should always be open to him doing something unexpected around us, especially when it comes to his kingdom. And that's a significant truth we see in this text. And so our passage tonight does not promise us that everything will always go the way we want it to in this life, but it does still strike a blow against our tendency, we might say, towards overconfident pessimism. Now, biblical wisdom calls on us to acknowledge and to take into account and to realistically plan for the ways things might go badly, whether in life or in ministry. And some folks do really fail to do that, and that we might call a form of overconfident optimism. But others fall into the opposite error. We tend towards overconfident pessimism. If something can go wrong, then we expect that it will go wrong. As we consider a plan, we're quick to shake our heads, to expect the worst, to insist to others that things will certainly end badly. And then when others protest, we simply explain that we are just realists. I know that I can tend to fall into this category. And I think it is, in some ways, maybe especially a tendency among what we might call Presbyterian personalities. And so maybe there's a few of you that fall into this category as well. And perhaps if we've been reading the accounts of Paul's experiences so far in Acts, reading what's happened to him in Pisidia and in Iconium and in Lystra and in Philippi and in Thessalonica, we can find ourselves feeling reinforced in that pessimism. But it's just then, it's maybe just at that point that the Lord here reaches out and corrects that overconfident pessimism with this account of unexpected ministry success in Corinth, as a bunch of things really just go unexpectedly well. And it's a correction that we may need to hear. Because however difficult our circumstances may be, however improbable spiritual and gospel success might seem to us from a human vantage point, if Jesus is always with us, and if Jesus is always sovereign, and if Jesus will do whatever he wills to do, then we should always be open to him doing something unexpected around us, especially when it comes to his kingdom. And we see that play out in several ways here in our text. Let's look at a few of them, and as we do, let's consider how they apply to our own lives and to the gospel work that the Lord has called each of us to with others in our lives. First, in this passage, God uses, we might say, unexpected ambassadors to do his work. Now, we might not see this at first, but I think a first century reader would. Paul has gone, we should note, from speaking with the honored and respected philosophers of Athens just a few verses earlier, to working a trade in verse 3. Now, in Jewish thinking at the time, this would be no problem at all. Rabbis, and Paul had been trained as a rabbi, were required to learn a trade to support themselves by physical work, as they also engaged in intellectual work. But Greek culture tended to despise manual labor. As one commentator puts it, by lodging with an artisan couple and beyond that, actually joining in their trade, Paul suddenly appears no longer as the rising star among noble ladies and gentlemen and lofty academicians. By engaging in manual labor here, Paul made himself, in the eyes of the Greeks around him, an unexpected ambassador of the one true God, an unlikely teacher, we might say, of deep spiritual truths. If the philosophers of Athens saw Paul working with his hands, they probably would have scoffed at taking him seriously as a philosophical thinker. We know also that the Corinthians were distressed by Paul providing for himself in this way. It comes up later in the letters to them. But of course, Jesus has no problem with this at all. Unexpectedly to the eyes of the Greeks around him, he uses this tradesman as his ambassador to speak his word. And while we should be informed by the same biblical worldview that sees no contradiction between working with our hands and working with our minds, it should also, as we consider this text, as we think of how the Corinthians would have responded to it, it should cause us to consider whether we too can at times fall into the Greek error that we see here. This Greek error, contrary to the Bible, of seeing some sort of contradiction between these two things, between working with one's hands and with one's mind. Do you maybe find yourself assuming that the Lord won't use you to extend his kingdom in certain ways because of your line of work, because of your socioeconomic status, or because you're a stay-at-home parent, or because you don't have certain letters after your name? That's not, of course, a biblical way of thinking. First, because knowledge and intellect and wisdom are not the same thing as advanced formal education, but second, because Jesus is not limited by any culture's assumptions about the kind of person he should use. And that point, then, in a different way, is driven home further as we consider Priscilla and Aquila. As we learn later on in chapter 18, this Jewish believing couple exiled from Rome had a partnership with Paul that extended beyond making tents and into providing theological instruction to others. And so, as we think of this couple, it's noteworthy that in a culture that often didn't respect the intellectual contributions of women, the Lord used Priscilla, a woman in the ancient world, not just to support and help Paul, but to work with him. Both Priscilla and Aquila leave with Paul in verse 18. Paul will then later leave them both in Ephesus, presumably to do ministry work, and both of them will instruct Apollos in the faith, providing theological instruction that will lead him to become a leader in the church later on. And as some commentators point out, the fact that Priscilla is often mentioned before her husband may indicate that of the two, she was the more prominent in ministry work. A woman would not have been an expected ambassador of the one true God in the ancient world, but we're reminded here that Jesus often works through unexpected ambassadors, at least those who would not be expected in the eyes of this world. Which means that we also need to be careful not to adopt worldly assumptions about who God will use and who God won't use, whether we tend to apply those assumptions to ourselves or to others. So where do you tend towards such worldly assumptions? And how might this text challenge you to change that attitude? The first thing we see here is that because Jesus is present with his people, and because Jesus is sovereign, and because Jesus will do as he wills to do, he might choose to do his work through unexpected ambassadors, at least unexpected in our eyes. Second, this passage reminds us that Jesus may call us at times to an unexpected mission field. From a human perspective, Corinth was a terrible place to go to try to make new Christians. Paul himself later wrote that he came to Corinth, he writes, in weakness, with great fear and trembling. Now, what caused that fear and trembling? Well, John Stott writes this. He writes, it was surely the pride and immorality of the Corinthian people which intimidated Paul, since the cross of Christ comes into direct collision with both. As Stott and other commentators go on to explain, the Corinthians were a proud people, marked by intellectual arrogance. Corinth was a new and bustling city which boasted both wealth and culture. Their arrogance would seem to set them up as poor candidates for the gospel of a God who died in humiliation on a cross. Then along with that, Corinth was also infamous for its sexual immorality, even in the Greco-Roman world, which as a whole was known for such things. Corinth hosted a temple of Aphrodite where 1,000 female slaves served the goddess, and then roamed the city's streets by night as prostitutes. The sexual promiscuity of Corinth had become proverbial in the ancient world, so that words that had the name of Corinth in them came to mean to practice immorality or came to be a way of referring to a prostitute. In such a city, the Christian sexual ethic would seem not just foreign, but absurd. Corinth, as a result of these things from a human vantage point, was a terrible mission field, which might seem not at all worth the effort. And yet, Paul goes anyway. And then, once he's there, Jesus tells him to stay. He says to Paul, "Go on speaking and do not be silent." Or other times, Paul moved on after opposition reached a certain level. Here, Jesus tells him to stay. Jesus calls Paul in a special way to this especially unlikely mission field. Now, when we think of this for ourselves, we should not expect a vision like Paul received. But at the same time, often through providence, through the circumstances of life, the Lord often places us in unexpected mission fields. And when he does, it's often in those moments that we can be tempted to that overconfident pessimism. But our text calls us instead to be open to the possibility that the Lord might do something that we would not expect. And so, what unexpected mission fields has the Lord placed you in? Who has the Lord given you especially a heart for? Or maybe who has he just put in your life in an obvious and even unavoidable way? Maybe for you it's a coworker, or maybe it's a neighbor, or maybe it's a friend or a family member. Maybe it's someone you've met in some other setting, but in any case, the Lord has placed non-Christians in your life, including some who seem, at least to your eyes, to have little potential for listening to or rightly responding to the gospel. And yet, as the Lord has placed you there, and as he's given you opportunity, he has called you to that mission field, no matter how unlikely success may appear to you. Now, of course, that's not a call to be obnoxious in such settings. As we've already seen, Paul isn't shy about his faith, but he's also careful and thoughtful about how and where and when he speaks of the gospel, and we're ordinarily to do the same. But still, especially maybe when we think those thoughts, we need to be careful to note that there is a difference between being careful and going quiet out of fear, or refusing even to try out of some kind of overconfident pessimism that they'll never listen anyway, so really, why bother? Our text urges us against such overconfident pessimism. Because if Jesus is with us, and if Jesus really is sovereign, and if Jesus will do what he wills, then he really might call us to speak his truth to those we wouldn't expect to listen. He may call us to an unexpected mission field. That's a second unexpected turn we see here. Third, this passage reminds us that Jesus may call us to unexpected persistence. It was one thing for Paul to speak in Corinth briefly. It was another for him to stay for a year and a half, as verse 11 indicates. And some commentators suspect, based on verse 18, that Paul stayed even longer than that. A year and a half or more is far longer than Paul stayed in many of the places he visited. He shows really an unexpected persistence here in this particularly hostile mission field. Now, the Lord gives Paul a vision, as we've said, but still at the same time, we don't necessarily need a vision to discern that the Lord may be calling us to persistence as well by pushing us, whether internally or externally through circumstances outside of our control, into an ongoing relationship with someone. Sometimes the Lord just keeps putting the same person, maybe the same non-Christian, even into our path again and again. Like a coworker we just keep getting paired with, or the parent whose child keeps ending up in the same sports or activity group as ours, or some other circumstance in which we see them again and again, even if we hadn't intended, even if they're not at all interested in the things of the Lord, and yet we keep coming into contact with them. And so we're called then to persist in loving them well. Other times the Lord puts someone in our life in an obviously long-term way. Your next-door neighbor or your family member may not seem like a strategically promising mission field to you, but the Lord has clearly put them in your life for the long haul, which means that you are called to love them. And part of loving them is being a witness to them. We may be called to persist in loving and witnessing to people who seem like unexpected candidates for the gospel. But again, if Jesus is with us, and if Jesus is sovereign, and if Jesus will do what he wills to do, then he can call us to persist in ministering to whomever he wants, whether it makes sense to us or not. Fourth, this passage reminds us that Jesus may provide unexpected defenders for us along the way. If we've been reading Acts up to this point, then as the Jews reject Paul in verse 6, and as they bring him to the pagan leaders in verse 12, we may expect things to take a bad turn at this point. It's certainly how it's gone before. But then once more, the unexpected happens here. In verse 14, before Paul can even open his mouth to defend himself, Gallio, the Roman proconsul, dismisses the charges out of hand. Gallio becomes an unexpected defender of the Christians in Corinth. And then things get even stranger. In verse 17, the crowd seizes Sosthenes and beats him, and Gallio ignores it. Now, it's not 100% clear on what's happening here, but Sosthenes was a ruler of the synagogue, we're told, either a replacement or a remaining co-leader after Crispus's conversion. And so he was probably one of the men who brought charges against Paul to Gallio. Commentators differ on who they think the crowd might be who attacked him here. Some see it as pagan Greeks who turn on Sosthenes. Others think the crowd may be other Jews who attack Sosthenes for bungling the case before Gallio. Either way, Gallio ignores the whole thing. And here's what I think we need to see here. Sin is everywhere in this event. Sosthenes, if he indeed is one of the accusers of Paul, has done what he's done in sin. The crowd, whether it's Greeks or Jews, carried out an act of mob violence in sin. Gallio, by failing to act justly and intervene, by failing to keep the peace, also committed sin. Sin's everywhere, and God is not the author of sin, neither does he approve of sin, but he does at times redirect sin against itself and use human sin against itself. And here, while all these characters are opposed to Jesus and the gospel, while on one level spiritually they should be allies, the Lord in his sovereignty sets them against one another so that they all seem to attack each other. And in the process, God's people are shielded. As a result, we read in verse 18, Paul was able to stay in Corinth even longer after all of this happened. Some think another 6 months or more. Rather than leaving Corinth because he was forced out, as had happened so many times in other cities in the past, Paul only left Corinth when he was good and ready, because the Lord provided unexpected defenders for him. Which really is exactly what Jesus promised he would do in verses 9 and 10, when he said, "Do not be afraid, but go on speaking, and do not be silent, for I am with you, and no one will attack you to harm you." Now, Jesus did not work in that specific way all the time for Paul, of course, but he did hear, and he could whenever he willed to. Which is an important reminder to us as Christians that when the culture around us seems increasingly set against our faith, whether on the big picture of the world as a whole, or our country, or our state, or our city, or our local community, or our workplace, when the culture or community we live in at any level seems increasingly set against our faith, we don't need to panic or despair, because we don't know what the Lord will do with that situation. Maybe, at least in terms of the things of this life, it will turn out badly. That's certainly possible, and at different times and places, for reasons unknown to us, the Lord has allowed that to happen. He's allowed it to happen as he has his own plans for what he's carrying out. And Paul knew that kind of experience firsthand. But also, on a human level, maybe it won't turn out badly. Maybe he'll provide unexpected defenders. Maybe he'll provide unexpected distraction to those who would otherwise focus their attention on us. Maybe he'll turn those who reject him against one another, as he does here. In any case, we don't know what the Lord will do. And our text reminds us that if Jesus is with us and Jesus is sovereign and Jesus will do what he wills, then he very well might provide unexpected defenses for us in a hostile setting. It's a fourth thing for us to consider from this text. Fifth and finally, this passage reminds us that Jesus can, of course, bring unexpected results from our efforts for his kingdom. Look again at the results in Corinth. They are unexpected. They're frankly strange. The Jews reject Paul and his message. They oppose and revile him, we read in verse 6. But then we're told in verse 8 that the ruler of the synagogue and his entire household accepted Paul's message and believed. Who would have seen that coming? Then, among the pagans in a city known for its idolatrous immorality, we're told in verse 8 that many of the Corinthians hearing Paul believed and were baptized. And that success apparently continued in the 18 months or more that followed. That result, in Corinth, of all places, humanly speaking, was completely unexpected. And why did Paul have such success? Why did he experience such outcomes? Well, verse 10 makes it clear. It's because Jesus decided he would. That's what the Lord means in verse 10. When Jesus says to Paul, "I have many in this city who are my people," he seems to be talking about people who have not yet come to believe, but whom Jesus has chosen for himself and decided that he will replace their hearts of stone with hearts of flesh so that they will ultimately place their trust in him. And so, because Jesus has decided to do that, because Jesus is able to do that, of all places, Corinth will be the one with many followers of Jesus. And the reason is simply because that's what Jesus in his sovereignty and his wisdom has decided to do. Which is an important reminder to us that no matter how hopeless a situation might seem, no matter how absurd it might seem to us that an individual or a group we know would ever come to know the Lord, wherever the Lord is calling you to labor for his kingdom, if you're seeing little reason for hope that anything will ever come of it, don't cynically assume that you know the end of the story. Maybe it will, in a sense, end in sadness. Maybe you'll never see the fruit that you've hoped and prayed for in this life. But maybe you will see that fruit. Either way, you don't know because it's not in your hands. It's in the Lord's hands. And the Lord has made followers for himself out of far more unlikely and unexpected converts than whomever it is that you feel ready to give up on at this point. So do not give up hope. Because if Jesus is with us, and Jesus is sovereign, and Jesus will do as he wills, and he can bring fruit from your work wherever he wants to, no matter how unlikely it may seem to you. When we zoom out again, and when we look at Paul's time in Corinth, what at first may seem like a loose collection of episodes with little relevance for our lives, we soon see has a unified theme, actually with deep relevance for our lives. It's a reminder to us that Jesus is always with us, that he is always sovereign, and that he will always do whatever it is he wills to do. That's what our text tonight reminds us of. And since that's true, if we really believe that, then we should always be open to Jesus doing something unexpected in our lives or in the lives of those around us, especially when it comes to matters of his kingdom. And so, brothers and sisters, let's push aside our overconfident pessimism, our worldly cynicism, and let's do the work that Jesus has given us to do, entrusting the ultimate outcome to him and being open to the possibility that he just might do something that we had never expected. Amen.